You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we explore the American dream and what it means to acquire status in our country based on merit, it is an hour-long conversation. So back in the 60s, people championed meritocracy, that if you work hard and have talent, you'll succeed. Meritocrats work hard in school, they work harder on the job, and richly rewarded for their efforts. So where is the rub? One take is the elite achieve and the middle class are left out of the equationing, widening gap. Do you think you can achieve through talent and smarts alone? Do you think a parent's path in life sets the stage for what doors opened for you? Can you be off the clock at work and still move up or make ends meet? We're at 800-642-1234. Daniel Markovitz is a professor at Yale Law School. His new book is called The Meritocracy Trap: How America's Foundational Myth Feeds Inequality, Dismantles the Middle Class, and Devours the Elite. Daniel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start with meritocracy from you, the author, your story. How has your pedigree, you teach at Yale, you were educated at Yale, London School of Economics, Oxford, Harvard, how has your background informed the way you understand meritocracy?
I think in two ways. The first is that pretty much everything in my professional life that is valuable to me comes from the fact that I turned out to be good in school, and that got me, you know, places at universities and then jobs and so on. But the other part of it is that, although it's not that I come from hardship, I come from a professional family, but I went to a public high school in Texas, what would now be called an urban public high school. And in my high school, a lot of the kids I was in school with and I was friends with then and I'm friends with now were just obviously as smart as I was, did just as well on tests, could do things that I couldn't do in school. But now their career paths have gone differently from mine. And so I spent some time trying to figure out what in the system accounts for that difference. And that's one of the things that drove me to write the book.
What happened? Why did paths diverge from home base in Austin, Texas?
Well, I think the main story, and it's a story that I'm just a very small example of, is that over the past 30 or 40 years, wealthy parents, professional parents, parents who themselves have fancy educations, have both gotten more and more insistent on investing time and money in educating their children, and better at it. And so the gap between the kind of training that a child who's born to privilege gets in this country and the kind of training that a middle-class child gets has just grown and grown and grown. And at the same time, the job market has changed in such a way as really to favor exactly the kind of training that mostly only rich kids get. So that it used to be that if you were a hard worker and a smart person and had a high school degree, you could get a job in a city like Detroit in manufacturing and get skills on the job and work your way up. And by the time you were 50 or 60, you were doing pretty well. Those jobs no longer exist.
And so you had a pension.
And you had a pension and you had health care. And really importantly, you had on-the-job training at work. So that even if you didn't get educated in school, you got educated at work and you got the skills that enabled you to advance up the ladder in your company. And that no longer happens. And what that means is that if you have the kind of parents who can afford to give you fancy educations, you have a lot of advantages. And if you don't, it doesn't matter how naturally talented you are. It's very hard to keep up.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Yale Law Professor Daniel Markovitz about his new book, The Meritocracy Trap. You can join in through the hour. Do you think you can advance based on talent and hard work alone? Or do you need to already have some privilege in order to do the things like go to Ivy League school, for instance, or get a top tier job? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Daniel, some people may criticize meritocracy, arguing that if we haven't done enough to live up to it and make it real, you could say the problem is actually meritocracy itself. Why do you say that?
Well, look, there are two things that are going on. The first is that elites cheat to get ahead or to stay ahead. You know, the college admissions scandal last year, for example, is an instance of that, where people were bribing universities to get their kids in. In fact, it's worse than that, because the only thing that made that scandal criminal is that the universities didn't capture the proceeds of their own corruption. So if rich parents bribe the soccer coach to get their kids in, that's a crime. But if rich parents make a big donation to the university to get their kids in, that's allowed. So that's a real problem. But there's another part of the problem, which I think is not appreciated, but is much more important, much more consequential, which is that when rich families spend enormous amounts of money on educating their kids, then even if the universities themselves are pure and admit the students with the best test scores and the best grades, overwhelmingly rich kids get in. And that's when meritocracy produces inequality, when it operates exactly as designed.
Where do you see meritocracy then at the college level? I mean, are colleges, can they at all fix the problem or be pure in how they approach admissions?
Well, I don't think that the solution can be limited to the college level or even can start at the college level. It has to run through our whole school system. You know, the average public school in America spends maybe $15,000 per pupil per year educating its students in high school. A really rich district like Scarsdale, New York, might spend $30,000 a year. So that's twice as much per child per year. A really fancy prep school might spend $75,000 a year. So that's five times as much per child per year as the average public school. And all that spending is not deployed in wanton or casual ways. It's deployed ruthlessly to produce students who will then do well on tests. And there's no way to get equality in our country unless we can attack this massive difference in education between not the middle class and the poor, but between the rich and the hyper-rich and the middle class.
Yeah, you talk about the elite and then the rest, and you see this growing divide, growing chasm between the ranks of the elite and the middle class, not the middle class and the poor. Why is it not between the middle class and poor where you see divides?
Well, there is a divide between the middle class and the poor, and there's a lot of poverty in this country, and there's more poverty than, at least if you have my politics, is morally and politically acceptable. But, for example, last fall, the Bureau of the Census released in the same month two striking statistics. The first is that the poverty rate had reached a near all-time low. The second is that the share of income captured by the top 1% of households had reached a near all-time high. So we have at the same time rising concentration of extreme income and wealth at the top and low poverty, at least by our own historic standards. And that means that the rich are leaving the middle class behind, not that the middle class and the poor are separating.
We're exploring this argument that meritocracy is a big problem in our country, that it's causing this widening gap between the very elite and everyone else. Proponents of meritocracy could say, hey, success is due to brains. It's due to hard work. Author Daniel Markovitz's book is called The Meritocracy Trap, and you can join in. Who benefits from meritocracy? Do you think it's a system that ensures that the most qualified people advance or not? Do you think it's possible to have a true meritocracy where wealth and influence don't factor into outcomes, don't factor into the equation? Join in 800-642-1234 through the hour. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back with Daniel Markovitz in just a minute. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking at this argument that meritocracy breeds inequities in our society. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In a meritocracy, the winners, the people who benefit from the system, tend to think that their success is due to brains. It's due to hard work, not to the luck of the family they're born into. And Yale Law School professor Daniel Markovitz writes about how meritocracy divides society against itself. It remakes childhood and adulthood, the home and the office. The rich elites and the middle class move in such different worlds that they fall out of sympathy with each other. So what do you make of that argument? Do you think you can advance based on merit alone, or do you have to have some privilege in order to get the things you want in life? Join in 800-642-1234. Tweet us WPR Mornings. And Daniel Markovitz stays with us. Let's take a call now. Mark is joining us from Romance. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, in these discussions, one of the terms that I'm always fascinated by is the term elite. If you hear that somebody is elite, you make a logical assumption in your mind that, oh, well, somehow they deserve what they've got. And as the author is pointing out, they don't really deserve what they've got. They've been able to perhaps extract advantage from a system that is skewed against most people. And I'm not exactly sure what a better term would be for elite, but I just wanted to raise that because the playing field has long been tilted, and it's tilting more precipitously as time goes by.
Thank you so much, Mark, for that analysis. Daniel, what do you make of that that analysis of the word elite as well?
Well, this picks up actually on the historical origins of the word meritocracy, which is that it was invented very recently by an Englishman named Michael Young in the 1950s. And he couldn't use the word government by the best or government by the most virtuous because that word was already taken and it was called aristocracy. And so what Young did is he replaced the Latin root for virtue with the Greek root for virtue with the Latin root for earn, and so change aristocracy to meritocracy. But what your caller is pointing out is that it's not at all clear that meritocracy functions in our society so differently from the way in which aristocracy used to. These are both systems in which families pass privilege down through the generations. Now, there is one difference, which is that in aristocracy, all you need to do to assume your privilege is have your parents die. Your parents die and you get the title. Whereas in meritocracy, each generation has to, in a way, re-earn its privilege by working and training. So there's a sense in which there's a difference. But the new mechanism turns out to be pretty much as reliable as keeping privilege within the family as the old. And it has the added drawback that the rich, because they now work, feel that they deserve what they have. And that's costly as well.
Passing down that wealth. What happens, though, in the middle class where today many middle class wage earners, their children won't make what they make?
No. In fact, most middle class wage earners now can expect their children to be worse off economically than they are. And this drop in what's called absolute social mobility, that is to say that the next generation will be richer than the current generation, this drop is biggest in the middle class in America. So rich families are less likely to have their kids earn less than they do, and actually poor families are less likely to have their kids earn less than they do. But the drop in the middle class is absolutely enormous.
What does the work look like for, and we'll continue to use the word elite, it used to be the poor worked long hours and the wealthy didn't have to work as much or perhaps at all. And now, as you look at it, the wealthy work to gain and maintain their status very long hours. Where did you see that change?
So that change started happening in the 1970s and accelerated through the 80s and 90s. Today, if you look at, for example, law firms, which is a business obviously I know quite well, a typical partner at an elite law firm in a city like New York might be billing 3,000, maybe more than 3,000 hours a year. That means they're working 70, 80-hour weeks. And this is people not just in their 20s and 30s, but into their 40s, 50s, and 60s. If you look at managers at Fortune 500 or S&P 1500 firms, they're often working 60, 70, 80 hours a week. And these are requirements of the job in the current economic order. And that has two very bad consequences. One is it's just not good for the people who have to work that number of hours. But the other is, again, because they're working so hard, they become emotionally and morally committed to the proposition that they deserve all their advantages. And you can understand why someone would think that way. It just turns out not to be true.
We're talking with Daniel Markovits about his book, The Meritocracy Trap. Do you think it's possible to have a true meritocracy where wealth and influence don't have a role in outcomes? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in John now in Richland Center. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment. I'm totally in agreement with everything, but my situation is I got sick, and my two kids were coming up. We were unable to really support them well, but through it all, my daughter went forward, got her degree, and got a master's degree. She now works for one of the largest insurance companies in Minnesota. My son, he dropped out the first year of college. He now runs one of the largest recycle businesses in Montana. I agree totally, but I think it's what you do with what you have. And I just want to put that forward. We still have to keep trying and everything, but I think there is a possibility, but it comes from education and support of your children.
A lot there, John. It's what you make with what you have. There's support in there as well. Daniel?
Well, first of all, that's an incredibly impressive story of your children. And but there's another part of the situation, which is that exceptional people will do well and will overcome disadvantages, even structural disadvantages. But if we think about making economic and social policy, you know, most of us are ordinary, and most of us will do about average given our situation. And so we want to create an economy and a political situation in which people who are ordinary do well, rather than just you have to be exceptional to do well.
What goes into making a system like that?
Well, one thing that goes into it is a massive investment in education for everybody, widespread better education for everybody, reducing student-teacher ratios in public schools, investing much more in public schools. Another thing that goes into it is making it harder for elites to separate themselves out and educate themselves in narrow enclaves. So, for example, private schools and private universities in this country are taxed as charities. That means that alumni donations are tax deductible to alumni, and it means that endowments can grow without being taxed. But if you're in a world in which a university like mine, Yale, has an endowment of maybe $25 billion and has more students from households in the top 1% of the distribution than from the entire bottom half, that university should not be taxed as a charity, because it's not. It's a private club for rich people. And so those tax exemptions should be taken away unless the universities start admitting lots more working and middle class students. So both invest massively in education for middle class and working class people, and make it harder for rich people to give their kids special educations that are paid for by everybody else. That would be a very good start to creating a more equal society.
Let's bring in another call. Ian now in Milwaukee. Good morning, Ian.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good.
Okay, I just wanted to say that I believe that the entire system in this country, whether it be political, financial, even tax-wise, is set up by the privileged for the privileged. And the idea that people can make it and be one of them people is capped. It's set up in such a way that we will always be middle class or lower class. And I'll take my the response off the air. Thank you.
Right. So moving between classes is basically not possible in how the political and financial system is structured, Ian says. Daniel?
Yeah. So I think I have two kinds of reactions to that. The first is that in general, I think your caller is right. If you look at social mobility across the classes in this country, it's, for example, much lower in this country than in lots of other wealthy countries. In Scandinavia, social mobility by some measures is three times as high. So the odds that someone born into a lower middle class household will get into the top fifth of the income distribution, maybe three times as high in Denmark as in the United States. And the second thing is, your caller is absolutely right that the tax structure is massively skewed towards the rich. The income tax is not very progressive, and it's much less progressive in practice than on paper because the rich can pay for all sorts of ways of legal tax avoidance. The other very important tax that people don't think about enough is the Social Security wage tax. This is the biggest tax that most middle-class families pay, but the tax base is capped at about $130,000 a year. So you pay, roughly speaking, 10.5% tax on the first $130,000 you make, and after that you pay zero. And that means that wealthy people who make enormous incomes are paying a much lower tax rate on that tax than middle-class people. And that's a huge drag on middle-class wealth and on middle-class employment, and it's a real unfairness.
The book is called The Meritocracy Trap. We're talking with author Daniel Markovits with For the Hour. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Do you think college admissions is about merit and identifying the most academically accomplished students? Are affluent families at an advantage? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Back after this news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a programming note here. Join us this evening at 7 for live coverage of Governor Evers' State of the State Address. Our coverage will be hosted by WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson and PBS Wisconsin's Frederica Freiberg. Governor Evers will highlight priorities for 2020 before a joint session of the legislature, and State Senator Roger Roth will give the Republican response following the address. That's this evening at 7 right here on the Ideas Network. Right now we're talking about meritocracy. We're tracing this connection to rising inequality. Meritocracy was a term coined in the late 50s by a sociologist. Working definition here, an elite group of people whose progress is based on ability and talent rather than on class privilege or wealth. So the college you're accepted to, the job you land, isn't based on connections or pedigree, but rather who is best qualified, regardless of background. Is that possible? Can you spot merit and measure it? Can we achieve a so-called level playing field and prosperity for all? We're at 800-642-1234, and Yale Law Professor Daniel Markovits stays with us. His new book is called The Meritocracy Trap. Let's go back to the phones now. Tom is in Green Bay. Hi, Tom.
Hi. My comment is that I'm 88 years old. I went to University of Wisconsin in the 1950s. My tuition, I think, was $75 a semester.
Mm.
And the kids today are coming out of college. They have unbelievable student loans. They have insurance they can't get. They can't go to the doctor. And we have a real problem, and I look forward to seeing the book.
Tom, thanks for the call. What is the status when we have such high student loan debt in America, Daniel?
I think that's a very good question, and the facts are complicated here. One fact is that for most people who go to college, even given how expensive college has become, college remains an extremely good deal, an extremely good financial investment. The implicit rate of return on what you spend on going to college, even if you take into account lost earnings, is very high. So for most people, college remains a real winner of a choice. But at the same time, there are important groups of people for whom college has become a real burden, and student debt has become a burden, and college has become almost a kind of a scam. First of all, there are people who go to for-profit colleges, which are not providing educational value and are not providing career advancement that's anywhere near good enough to be worth what they cost. Second of all, we have in this country a huge college completion problem. So people get into college, they go, they spend a couple years, and then they don't finish. And because we bundle up education into big chunks that we call degrees, the value to you of 2 years of college education without a degree is almost zero. So you got to finish to get this big advantage. But of course, you're paying all along. And so the college non-completion problem is a huge cost to people. And the debt that your caller was talking about is particularly burdensome for people who expend half or three quarters what it costs to get through college, but don't actually finish their degree.
federal loans, federal grants, could they be more robust in limiting some of this risk that you're talking about?
I think they could be more robust. I think also that the interaction between private lenders and the federal government could be regulated in a way that prevents private lenders from exploiting both student borrowers and actually the Treasury and the federal government. I also think that there's a big role to play for private universities and private endowments, which again get massive subsidies. So just to give you a concrete example, Princeton's tax exemption has been calculated recently as being the equivalent of a public subsidy of $100,000 per Princeton student per year. Compared to that, Rutgers University, the State University of New Jersey, has public funds of about $12,500 per year. And Essex Community College, which is the community college up the road, has public subsidies of about $2,500 a year. So the private university, Princeton, gets 40 times the public subsidy that the local community college gets. And unsurprisingly, Princeton, again, is full of very rich students, and the local community college is full of working class and middle class students. So there's a lot of room there for forcing private educational endowments to redistribute more, to spend more on financial aid, and to spend more on financial aid for children who are not rich.
Well, let's bring in someone who defines themselves as a blue-collar worker, Tyler in Milwaukee. Hi, Tyler.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
More of a comment, I guess. I've kind of been raised thinking, I went to live in small-town Michigan and was brought up, I did originally go to college, but like you said, I dropped out eventually because I had to have a job in order to survive. I ended up getting into the trades now. And it's something that I've noticed. I have on-the-job training available to me. I'm a union trades member. And it's something that I've noticed, though, that in the trades, the superintendents, the people that are running the jobs, the upper echelon, usually it's their children that are joining. And they're the ones that are getting fast-tracked to those positions. It seems to be easier to do for them, and that may be training that they get as an adolescent growing up in the field, which I did grow up in the field, but it didn't. I was pushed towards college originally, but I wasn't a good fit for college, and the trades were a good fit, and it's just harder, and I feel that I have to work a little harder because my fellow journeymen and apprentices, I notice the ones that have families already in the trades are generally being picked for those next positions.
Very interesting. Tyler, thanks for that situation and that observation. Daniel, it sounds as if there is even fast tracking in the trades in terms of where you come from.
Yeah, I think that story really vividly brings out three incredibly important points. The first is, college may not be for everybody, and various kinds of vocational training and skill training in trades are an extremely important part of every good educational system. And that's a place in which America is falling short right now. The second is your caller emphasized that he's in a union. And in 1960, a third of the private sector workforce in America was in a union. Today, it's 1/16. And unions are incredibly important, not just for pushing up wages, but also for making sure that things like on-the-job training and workplace promotion are available to people. And then the third point is that, as your caller says, even outside of Harvard or Princeton, families find ways to have their children get ahead. And partly that's nepotism, but partly it's also that, as your caller also suggested, if from early youth you're taught about a skill or a trade or a way of working, and in your high school years, you maybe do some internships or you work with your parents and their jobs, you get some skills, you'll have an advantage when you're 20, 25 and are starting to advance through your own profession or career, because training works. There was even recently a study done that the sons of major league ball players have a higher chance of making the major leagues than other kids. And the person who did the study thought most likely it was because major league ball players helped teach their kids how to hit at an earlier age. You get education, you get good at things. And when you have a system that distributes education really unequally everywhere in society, it turns out that people's prospects are also really unequal.
We're talking with Daniel Markovits about his new book, The Meritocracy Trap. Still time for you. You can join in. Do you think we should rethink meritocracy? Does it solidify opinions that you already had? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Julian now in Glendale. Hi, Julian.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, absolutely.
I wanted to suggest that meritocracy is a smokescreen that obscures an invisible hand, a hand which determines where folks wind up on the social economic ladder. I'll give you an example of that. A child who gets a recommendation, a child of a family in an affluent neighborhood who gets a letter of recommendation or reference from an affluent neighbor, such as a lawyer, doctor, executive, that will go a long way in securing opportunities for that kid for whatever internship or college acceptance he's going for, or a child, a student at a affluent university, Ivy League university, whether they graduate or not, those networks and those people they meet, those families, those friends, these kids may not be so exceptional, but it's the network. And there was a sociologist, an American sociologist, I think his name was Mark Granovetter, who did a study on social networks and the strength of weak ties. And that network makes all the difference in the world. It's not often the exceptionalism that is the difference.
It's the
network.
Yeah, Julian, thank you. Daniel, how important is it to have those social connections in your where you are and who you know?
So your caller makes an excellent point, and Granovetter is exactly the sociologist. He's exactly right that these networks are very important, but it's also a question of how they operate and how they work. Let me give an example. I got a call a few years ago from somebody who offered me the following deal. He's like, I'm setting up a private tutoring system. Will you tutor some high school students for me? I'll pay you, he said, $1,000 an hour. And you're going to tutor my students, and my students are going to do really great work. And the only thing you need to do is meet with them or online for an hour a week and read their essays. And presumably at the end of that, what he was going to do is say, could you write a letter of recommendation, truthfully, saying that the student you tutored had done really good work. Now here's the thing. Part of it is exactly what your caller was talking about, namely, unless you have very rich parents, you're not paying some professor $1,000 an hour to tutor your kids. But part of it was also that it was essential to the system that if someone wrote such a letter, the letter would be true. So the network creates the opportunity to show merit. And that's the darkness in the system, that even when the merit is real, it's still unfair.
Pausing there with Yale Law Professor Daniel Markovits as our guide to this conversation about meritocracy. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about meritocracy. Sociologist Michael Young coined the term in the late 50s. He wrote in The Guardian nearly two decades ago, "A social revolution has been accomplished by harnessing schools and universities to the task of sieving people according to education's narrow band of values." And today we see many Ivy League schools talking about fixing meritocracy, doubling down on a commitment to inclusion and diversity, even rolling back legacy admissions. You can join in. Still time for you. 800-642-1234. And author Daniel Markovits stays with us. Let's go to Paul now in Middleton. Hi, Paul.
Well, good morning to you both. I was struck by the conversation. I was on the road, and I just got home. What guess irks me more than anything else is that you have, for lack of a better term, an elite with this recent revelation of the college gate, where these very well-off parents are buying positions by having their kids posed as athletes when they're not, by having individuals take their SATs and so on and so forth. I mean, they already have the whole game in their back pocket, and it's still not enough. And, you know, I, as a working slob, and that's what I am, I'm a working slob, you know, my children worked their tails off through college. I mean, they graduated with Latin honors and everything, and have gotten Fulbright research fellows and got a scholarship to the University of Oxford in England and everything else. And these people can just run rampant over everything. And it's, you know, it gives a lie to the notion of meritocracy. And ultimately, it's going to cause a very destabilizing effect on our political system.
And Paul, we are short on time, but is there a destabilizing effect, Daniel? Can this throw a whole system off if meritocracy is a myth?
Yes. Look, the scandal that your caller is talking about, it's an outrage. And he's exactly right. These are families that have everything, and yet they want to cheat to get more. At the same time, the biggest source of inequality is not that cheating. It's the system itself. So in a recent year, according to the College Board's own data, if you asked how many high school seniors were there who hit the Ivy League median on their verbal SAT from households with parents who had a graduate degree, the answer was about 15,000. If you ask how many high school seniors were there to hit the Ivy League median, neither of whose parents had a high school degree, the answer was under 100 in the whole country. And what that means is that the system, even when it does what it purports to do, creates massive structural inequality. And the inequality has become so great that there is no way that the system can stably sustain itself without somehow unwinding it. And the question for the next generation is going to be, do we unwind it in a way that is fair and just, or do we unwind it in a way that is brutal and destructive?
Is it too ingrained, though? Are we able to change it, unwind it? Can we actually undo what has been done?
Well, you know, there are historians who've done studies of this kind of concentrated income and wealth across space and time, all of human experience. And if you had to summarize those studies, the bad news is that there's only one instance in human history of a society that has had this much concentrated income and wealth that has managed to recover without losing a war or succumbing to a revolution. The good news is that that society is the United States in 1929. So we've done it before, and I think we have in our institutions and in our national character and in our culture the resources to do it again. But we've got to get clear that this is an urgent and pressing problem.
You see hope at the end of the
day. I do see hope. I do see hope. I see our politics moving in this direction. We finally are seeing major national politicians who are making correcting economic inequality a central part of their project.
Daniel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, and thanks to your callers. Let me just say, you know, nobody has to pay attention when somebody writes a book, and I'm incredibly grateful that people did.
Daniel Markovits is a professor at Yale Law School. His new book is called The Meritocracy Trap, How America's Foundational Myth Feeds Inequality, Dismantles the Middle Class, and Devours the Elite. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about the strength of human connection.
There's a national fellowship program that brings young African leaders to college campuses across the U.S. UW-Madison is one of the schools that partners with the Mandela Washington Fellowship. The most recent group included Folajigun Akilami of Nigeria. For more than a decade, she's worked in media and advocates for people with disabilities. She wanted to share her experience and introduce us to a friend she made while in Madison.
The first time I heard about Madison, Wisconsin, was when I received mail that I would be part of the Mandela Washington Fellowship Program. Once I arrived, five of us went to Gigi's Playhouse, a Down Syndrome Achievement Center for our community service. We were to volunteer there for 6 weeks, and I really couldn't wait to meet the kids. Before long, the children started arriving and we were all in class. I noticed the lady sitting across the table who wouldn't take her eyes off me. I smiled and asked for her name, and looking down, she introduced herself as Aileen. I tried to check out what she was drawing, and she hid it. To my surprise, when it was time for our weekly pictures, Haley stood right next to me. The following week, we took turns in selecting our favorite songs, and we danced to it together. When it was Haley's turn, she chose ABBA's Dancing Queen, and she said, "I'm dedicating this song to the most beautiful girl in the world, and I'm pleased to know that I'm dancing with you. This is to Fola, my best friend." I suffered polio as a child, and I have mobility issues. Not once have I ever considered myself the most beautiful girl in the room. But Haley stood there, in a room filled with people, and she said I was the most beautiful girl in the world. Tears filled my eyes as we danced to the song, and later that evening, she introduced me to her mom, Alana.
Haley would talk about all the things she and Fola did, and Fola shared gifts with Haley, including a very beautiful, special stole from Africa that she wore. When it was time for Fola and the other fellows to return to Africa, it was hard to say goodbye. Haley loves her so much.
Our last week at Gigi's Playhouse was the hardest. We did our final dance sessions, and Haley dedicated all our dance steps to me. She could really dance. When it was her turn to choose a song, she chose her favorite. This time, the tears that I have been trying to control all afternoon flowed freely. Haley chose Katy Perry's Never Really Over, and she danced her heart out. Never really over. Just because it's over doesn't mean it's really over. Such a young girl. So much innocence. So much energy. So much love.
I love Fola. She's a sweetheart. We did lots of things together at Gigi's Playhouse. We made vivain stitches, danced, played instruments, and played games. I am so glad that I met Fola, and I miss her very much.
I saw myself through Ellie's eyes, and I knew I was worth all the love. The way she loved me made me reassess and reevaluate myself. The purity and sincerity of her love taught me how to love myself even more. I knew right there and then she chose the right song. It's Never Really Over. 2 years and just like that, my head still takes me back. I love you, dear Haley, and I miss you so much.
Folajigun Akilami is a Mandela Washington Fellow who worked out of UW-Madison. She hosts the program Beyond Challenges in Nigeria. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
The Senate impeachment trial of President Trump resumes today at noon. You can hear live NPR coverage on WPR's News and Classical Network and online at WPR.org. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.
Never really over. Just because it's